Ted Lefroy is Director for the Centre of Environment at the University of Tasmania. And every month, couple of months, get him in just to shake up your ideas about the world, who we are, and how we live in it. Hello, Ted.
Morning, Rick.
Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Where have you just been?
I've been to New Zealand, Rick.
Oh, kia ora. How was that?
It was fabulous.
Where did you go?
Well, mainly South Island, Canterbury.
Okay.
Where they've had a massive increase in dairying and number of cows, and we're interested in seeing how they handled it.
It's been a disaster. So I was at uni with the guy who's now the leader of the Greens Party, James Shaw, and I said to him a few years ago, I said, what are your defining issues? Because in Tassie it was forestry. Well, I guess we've moved on from that a little bit. And he's like, oh, forestry? Well, it's just a crop. Why is anyone worried about that? Yeah. Like, this is the Greens Party. And he, no, don't be stupid. It's just you plant it, you chop it down, you grow it. That's normal. It's like, you know, hay, just slower. He said, dairying's the problem. We can have 10-20 million sheep, no problem. But what do lots of cows do to a landscape, Ted?
Well, they tend to put a lot of nitrogen back into it, Rick. But what interested us was how they're handling it. Because, okay, the area we went to, Canterbury, is about two-thirds the size of Tasmania. It has five times the area of irrigation, 500,000 hectares irrigated. It's got 1.2 million dairy cows. Tasmania has 150,000. So they're an order of magnitude bigger further down the road. Mm. And what was interesting was what's different about New Zealand, as well as the way they're handling it. So Tasmania is a way, in a way, is protected by geography because we have lots of small catchments. You know the Canterbury Plains. You've got a huge area of gently sloping land from the Southern Highlands down to the Pacific Ocean. Most of it was cleared and being farmed or used for growing food when Europeans first got there. So I can understand that fellow's attitude towards forestry because it is another crop. You know, they were used to obvious signs of agriculture there when the British first arrived. Okay, but the way they've handled dairying is very interesting. And what we wanted to go and see in particular is the way they develop the collaborative process they're using to develop targets for managing water quality. So what they originally started out doing was setting a limit on the amount of nitrate that each farm could or nitrate pollution or leaching into the water table, and the courts were just tied up. The environment courts were tied up with these cases. So what they did instead is set up these district zones or committees and said, well, look, here's all the modelling, here's all the science we've done, here's the hydrology. You work out what you think you can do to protect the towns like Christchurch on the coast from this big slug of nitrate water heading towards it.
Because this is the thing, if you're not aware of what dairying with that intensity does, is that it puts all of that into the water systems and destroys them. So this was the thing everyone's so worried about in New Zealand. The waterways were dying.
Yeah.
The drinking water was getting affected, but also the cows just structurally break down all the riverbanks and destroy it and destroy all the paddocks and everything. So the entire system starts to...
Yeah, but a lot has happened since then.
For instance, trouble.
One of the big dairy companies, Fonterra, will not pick up milk from a farm that hasn't fenced off all the creeks and waterways.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot has been happening.
Yeah.
But the other thing that there are some major differences in New Zealand. One is the fact they have regional councils. So when you go to a local government election here, you elect a district council. In New Zealand, you elect a district council, which does the things our local government, local council does, and a regional council, which is just for environmental management. And about a third of the rates go towards them.
Really?
So Environment Canterbury is this organisation that has funded a huge amount of modelling and studies and is managing this collaborative process for arriving at water management targets. And what impressed us was each of these zone committees, which are all volunteers, so farmers, members of the Maori community, Greens groups, NGOs, and they say, if you can come up with a target and if you can have unanimous support for that from your community, then the council will make that statutory regulation and we'll just gazette it and that's it. If you can't do it, we'll enforce it. So they've given them, they say, you work it out amongst yourselves. You're the people that have to live there.
So they've laid out a whole lot of carrots.
Yep.
And go, if you can eat the carrots, great. If not, we still have a stick.
Yep.
Or a stick, as they call it. Off you go. Yep. And what sort of ideas are people coming up with through this process? Are they coming up with different kinds of ideas?
Well, they're having to confront the reality that instead of, and this is the difference between New Zealand and Australia, there's still quite an attitude here of a right to farm. The language we heard from the farmers, we went to a couple of irrigation groups and talked to farmers, they talk about the resource consent to farm. So instead of a right to farm, it's a consent. The community gives them the consent to farm. And
That's a big
shift. It's a big change in attitude. And I realise, as you say, that there historically have been problems with that rapid intensification, but it's the way they've gone about handling it that impressed us. And what surprised me was the more we interrogated, how did you come up with this approach and why are you doing it? We go right back to a reforming government in the 80s. So in 84 to 90, I think, the Longy government, Longy and Geoffrey Palmer, two critical pieces of legislation, a Resource Management Act, and they changed the Local Government Act to set up these regional councils for environmental management.
Just off 6:45 on ABC Radio Hobart, Ted Lefroy is Director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania and a real thought leader in the area of environment. And he just pops in. We have these chats about the big ideas that he's mulling over, because this is where, I guess, the crest of the wave will be in thinking in Australia around these issues. So this idea that you need consent to do things to the land is a kind of very post-colonial idea, isn't it? Because we're still in Australia in the thing of like, it's my land, I've got the land, it's my land, shush, shut up, don't talk about it, don't talk about it. In Tassie, you know, farmers are very uncomfortable to explain, for example, if you walk over their land, that there's obvious evidence of Aboriginal occupation on the surface of nearly every bit of nice land everywhere in Tasmania.
And this is what surprised us. Every group of people we spoke to, and we spoke to about 30 people from 15 different organisations, from national government to regional council to farmers' groups, everywhere we went, they mentioned the Treaty of Waitangi. So that was signed in 1840 between the British and about 500 Maori chiefs. But that
and completely ignored by all governments, despite protests by Māori people, until that same government, the Longy government, acknowledged it.
Yeah, but the thing that surprised me about the treaty is I thought it's signed and then that's it, but it is constantly being breached and renegotiated, and it's still being negotiated.
Yeah. It's been really good for lawyers, eh? Terrific.
But it's also changed the way that people think about things. And one of the farmer groups that we went to said that the Māori are not stakeholders in this process, they are partners, equal partners. And that, you know, the fact that the Treaty of Waitangi is mentioned in most major pieces of legislation, it's mentioned in the Resource Management Act, it acknowledges that the land was owned and managed prior to the European arrival, and that everything to do with land management needs to be negotiated.
And out of that, I think, has come another whole layer in New Zealand where, and, you know, Aboriginal people across Australia have been trying to tell us this forever, is that the land itself, without them, also is its own entity. So when you're talking about consent, which is so appropriate in this Me Too 2018 time, you know, talk about consent among people, thinking about consent with the land, it's not just consent from original inhabitants, but it's in a way a sense that the land prior even to them is its own self. And New Zealand's given land identity legally in some interesting ways.
Exactly. The whole idea of tenure is inverted. It's tenure of land over people rather than people over land. And so that idea you'd think would bang up against the idea of private property and property rights, but what it's meant is that people are prepared to negotiate.
Take us through that idea again.
Our idea of property is that of tenure is that a person has tenure over land.
It's my
Indigenous
land.
Idea is tenure of land over people. I belong to the land. Land doesn't belong to me. So even though it may seem, you know, it's a long way away, a long, long time ago, 1840, the treaty just kept coming up and we kept asking about it. And and at one point, we were sitting down and talking to one of the commissioners for Environment Canterbury, who happened to be a man called David Cagle, who'd been the finance minister in the Longy government. So we had the advantage of someone explaining, he was a lawyer, explaining how that history, how New Zealand's initial conditions had influenced the way that legislation is drafted and enacted and the way that people behave. And this is not to deny they've got some serious problems with water management, but what was interesting is their settlement history and their legislative history.
And so you're coming around the table with a different group of people if they all agree on that idea,
yeah,
rather than at the moment where we try and come together and have these conversations in Australia, and you've got New South Wales telling Victoria, it's my river, no, it's my river.
Yeah.
You've got farmers versus indigenous. It's all verse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Aboriginal people, the farmers saying it's my land, and they're saying, no, the land's the land.
Yeah.
You're the custodian, you know. Yeah. So we're still fighting over these basic ideas.
Yeah.
And you're suggesting in New Zealand there's at least a point of agreement that then can come back into legislation and the idea of ownership and property. So do people still feel they have property?
Oh, of course. Of course they do. And it makes you realise that the two concepts are not completely incompatible. Very recently there was a settlement through the Treaty of Waitangi where one of the iwi, one of the tribes on the Canterbury Plains, got a settlement in the order of $500 million.
Mm.
So what did? They bought a dairy farm, a forestry operation. They're running a very successful business. And they're setting an example.
What would have to happen here?
Well,
Ted Lefroy.
Okay, you can't wind back the clock. You can't wind back history. A big difference in New Zealand was that Maori land management and land use was so much more obvious and apparent. I'm not excusing the first colonial administrators, but they didn't have the eyes to see that there was land management active in Australia before they arrived.
Or, according to Bruce Pascoe's book, which you brought to this program.
And a actually, copy of which you've still got, by the way.
Yes, yeah, don't ever lend me anything. It's a lesson you learn too late. It's talking about ownership. The evidence was there. People did totally see it. And then that was sort of hushed up.
They couldn't afford to see it. This is the interesting thing about First Contact, the explorer's diaries. It was apparent to them. But the administrators
that Aboriginal people were actively farming the land as we would understand it.
Yeah. But once the decision had been made and terra nullius had been used as a legal instrument, it was very difficult, if not impossible, for them to turn around and reverse.
But can we talk about that now? Can we
of
say, let's look at our country from how we saw it and
it's not
create
too late.
A new relationship?
It's not too late. And the idea of the treaty from the heart, which was an opportunity and has been ignored, it made me realise the advantage of having that treaty, that it's not a once and only thing. It's constantly negotiated, but it changes the tone of the conversation.
Well, look, there's an amazing opportunity for a premier with a huge majority and 4 years and a desire to reset the relationship with the Aboriginal people of Tasmania. Fax that one through to Will Hodgman. What do you reckon? Ted's looking really nervous now. We could just do it first here, couldn't we?
It's a national thing. Oh, I suppose you could set a precedent. But I think the idea that in all these... The first thing was, don't just decide and defend about regulations. Collaborate, negotiate, and see what a community can come up with. As you say, with the legislation behind you, if that doesn't work, we will rule. But the other thing is to have the traditional owners as equal partners, not stakeholders.
And farmers as collaborators, not defenders. It's such an interesting idea, and so many people on the land would describe themselves as feeling like that too.
And this is what we got from conversations with farmers.
Yeah.
This was not contentious.
Ted, great to talk to you this morning.
You too.